nyu.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking about an extraordinary story which unfolded not all that far from us, something which unfolded in the early 1920s in South Bend, Indiana, and it involves Notre Dame University and, believe it or not, the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan was a very potent force in the state of Indiana in the early 20th century. And we sometimes forget that at least at certain points in its history, the Ku Klux Klan reserved some of its most potent hatred and suspicion for Roman Catholics in this country. And so it was almost inevitable that these two forces would clash. And so they did, most memorably in 1924. But memorable though the clash may have been, it is also something which has faded into extraordinary oblivion. And we can read, however, about this important and interesting moment in our history in this new book from Loyola Press by Todd Tucker. The book is called Notre Dame versus the Klan, How the Fighting Irish Defeated the Ku Klux Klan. Todd Tucker is a graduate himself from Notre Dame University with a major in history. He was for a time an officer in the U.S. Navy's nuclear submarine force. He is the author of another book called Notre Dame Game Day. Is written for several national magazines, soon to be writing a new book for Simon & Schuster. He makes his home in Valparaiso, Indiana. And I'm really grateful to Todd Tucker for joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about this particular book and this fascinating story of Notre Dame and the Ku Klux Klan. Todd Tucker, we welcome you to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Greg.
Tell us just a little bit about your experience at Notre Dame. What was it like for you to go to this marvelous school?
Well, it was great. I went there on a Navy scholarship, and couldn't have gone there otherwise. Got there in 86 and graduated in 90, and that was a charmed time to be at Notre Dame. My first year was Lou Holtz's first year, and my sophomore year, Tim Brown, who lived in my dorm, Kavanaugh Hall, won the Heisman Trophy, and my junior year we won the national championship, so it was a great time to be there.
Wow. Yeah, we see football mentioned at several points in this book. You are apparently a fan, maybe a former player yourself?
Not a former player, just a former and current fan.
Right. Very good. One thing that is, of course, so interesting is that here you go to Notre Dame, and you don't know anything, and so many people that go to Notre Dame, even work at Notre Dame, know nothing about this event which occurred in 1924. Tell our listeners the very interesting story about how this incident with the Ku Klux Klan first came to your attention.
Well, I was a history major, so maybe I was more in tune with the history of the institution than the average student. But I'd heard mentions of it. It was kind of part of the folklore of the school, but I never really heard anything, any of the detailed stuff about D.C. Stevenson or Father Walsh or any of the real, the real interesting details of the story. So I just started looking at it and found, the wealth of interesting characters, and it was perceptive in your introduction. You said it was inevitable that these two institutions collide, because I really think that's true. And what's interesting is, within a year of the riot, D.C. Stevenson had been convicted, the Grand Dragon, had been convicted of murder, and Notre Dame, under Newt Rockne, had won its first national championship. So you could kind of see, the riot took place, it was a real crossroads for both institutions.
Hmm. You discovered at some point early on that one of the principal participants, at least among Notre Dame students, was the grandfather of a friend of yours.
Yeah, what happened was I talked to there are a few gentlemen who are still alive that were at the Rite. If you were a freshman at Notre Dame in 1924, you'd be about 98 today. So there's not too many of these guys left. But I talked to one, a guy named I.I. Probst. He lives in Fort Pierce, Florida. And he sent me a bunch of stuff, kind of his personal archives. And one of the things he sent me was kind of a poor quality photograph, Xerox of a photograph, of a Notre Dame student in Klan robes. And you can see that that picture's in the book.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's great. You know, a picture of this Notre Dame kid kind of clowning around in the robes that he'd stolen from a Klansman that he probably roughed up in the process. So I asked him if he knew the guy's name, and he said, well, sure. He said it was a friend of his, a guy named William Fooey. And I thought, well, I knew a Fooey at Notre Dame. How many Fooeys can there be? So I kind of looked into it, and it turns out the guy in the picture, William Fooey, was the grandfather of a friend of mine and fellow Kavanaugh Hall resident, Mark Fooey. And so I called Mark up one day and said, Mark, you're not going to believe this photograph I have of your grandfather.
Mm. And one of the points that you make in talking about this little bit of the story is that this young man's grandfather, like many people involved in this, really did not say much about this event that they had participated in.
Never did. Didn't say anything to his brother, who went to Notre Dame 10 years after him, and certainly never said anything to his grandson. And I think it's interesting to point out that, you know, institutionally, Notre Dame has certainly never made a point of talking about those 3 days either.
Although you say it did live on to some extent in kind of the communal folklore of the school.
Kind of in the collective memory. I tell a story in the book about how there was a building on campus that we always told each other had dead bodies in the basement. And, you know, there was never any reason why Notre Dame doesn't have a medical school, but we always heard that story. And I found out when I was researching the book that, in fact, that's true. So I was kind of trying to make the point that just because something's a myth doesn't mean that there's not an element of truth to it, like the Klan riot.
We're talking with Todd Tucker. His book is called Notre Dame Versus the Klan, How the Fighting Irish Defeated the Ku Klux Klan. It points to an incident which occurred in South Bend, Indiana, in 1924. One of the things you do, Todd Tucker, which I think is of great benefit to most readers, is that you tell us the story of how Notre Dame was founded and by whom. And you also lay for us a detailed, textured context of what it meant to be Roman Catholic in the United States in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And how at different points in time, Catholics were sometimes a bit at odds with a more predominantly Protestant population.
Well, I think that it's without question. And I think a lot of Catholics maybe have forgotten this. Speaking of collective memory, but there were Catholics, and especially Catholic immigrants, which, you know, most Catholics were from immigrants. Were a feared minority, and they were feared because it was thought that they were going to somehow fundamentally change the nature of America. And that was really the kind of the interesting thing about this in terms of the book, is that it was that movement, this growth of the Catholic immigrant population, that fueled the growth of both Notre Dame and the Klan. That, you know, the growth of the Catholic middle class was really what, you know, was kind of spurred, you know, both movements, so to speak.
You talk about how in a place like South Bend, Indiana, which had been largely Protestant, mm-hmm. and where this new school, Notre Dame du Lac, as it was called initially, Our Lady of the Lake, that there at least eventually sprung up what you call an uneasy truce.
Well, yeah, when Notre Dame was founded up there in the 1840s, it was very much a Protestant stronghold, as the university grew and started to thrive, you know, both groups of people, and, you know, there was plenty of suspicion on both sides there, the Catholics and the Protestants, but both groups kind of realized that they were going to have to learn how to live together, you know, so that was, but by the time of the riot in 1924, South Bend and that whole kind of northern tier of Indiana was really the only part of Indiana where there was a large immigrant Catholic population. and that was because of the steel mills and other industry. But by the time of the riot, South Bend was, you know, probably one of the stronger Catholic immigrant areas of the state.
Tell us about this intriguing and even courageous figure who founded Notre Dame.
Yeah, he is an interesting guy. His Father Soren. He was French. Notre Dame, for being so famously identified with the Irish, was a French institution at birth. And some of the older, in the older kind of core of the campus, you can still kind of see that in the architecture. There's kind of almost a New Orleans flavor to some of the old buildings. And it was Father Soren. He came over here. He ended up in Vincennes, Indiana, a French settlement in southern Indiana, which is actually the oldest city in Indiana. And Soren, being kind of a contentious guy, immediately kind of started butting heads with the bishop down there. And after many, many battles, the bishop finally made a deal with Soren and said, I'll let you open this college you want to open, but you got to take this land in northern Indiana to do it. This land had been given to the archdiocese. And so Soren took it. He knew it would be a challenge, but he was convinced that this was his mission in life, to build this great Catholic university. So he went up to the wilds of northern Indiana and built it. And in his lifetime, saw it go from basically three dilapidated log cabins into a school with a national reputation.
You talk about how this was really, at least on the face of it, a far-fetched, rather outlandish idea, given that there were hardly any Catholics there, and it was just in such a remote sort of,
well,
of region. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine that now, but
the challenges that they had, I mean, it's you almost have to laugh when you read it. I mean, he had to, first of all, to get from Vincennes to South Bend, he had to go about 300 miles across a completely virgin wilderness. The group of, it was Soren and a small group of Holy Cross brothers. They had 250 miles to go, and they made 5 miles on their first day. When they got up there, they had to make everything themselves, all the boards, all the bricks, all the food. And, it was just insane. And it's the kind of thing that I think a person has to almost have a strong religious belief to get it done, because I don't think you would ever do it otherwise if you didn't have that belief. And Soren never, he never wavered. And one of the most well-known stories about Soren is in 1879, the great fire came and destroyed most of campus. And it was, basically Soren's life work was in ashes. And he walked around and kind of surveyed the wreckage, and then he went to the church, which had been spared, and he told everybody, he said that it was his fault that it had burned down because he'd been thinking too small. And he said his famous line was, he said, if it was all gone, I would not give up. And they rebuilt it, and they actually had the campus up and running by the time the students returned in the fall.
He was
an amazing guy.
Yeah, and you said those words that he spoke there were greater than any halftime pep talk ever given by a Notre Dame football coach. And what rises out of those ashes is the grand golden dome,
right,
which is one of the most recognizable symbols of Notre Dame today.
Yeah, that was what they built in its place, kind of fulfilling Soren's pledge to, think even bigger. And one thing that's interesting about kind of the Catholic American experience is that inside that building, they decided to paint these murals of Columbus, and it was kind of deliberately chosen as to show, Catholics' rightful place in the American dream, since Columbus was on ostensibly a Catholic mission there.
Hmm. You also mentioned one other story about Father Soren, which is interesting and says something about him, and that is that one of the last battles, I guess you could say, he fought is concerned this dome,
right,
which he wanted not just to be gold colored, but covered with real gold.
Right. And Notre Dame, I mean, when you read the early history of Notre Dame, it's just a story of just, I think I say it in the book, it's a story of just constant financial crisis punctuated by periodic catastrophic fires. So the school did not have a lot of money to throw around. But Soren was insistent that they put real gold on this dome. And finally, the board of administration, which was normally, a rubber stamp for whatever Soren wanted, said, we're not going to put real gold on there. It's too extravagant. And so Soren took a couple of kind of legalistic maneuvering to shut down the board until they gave him what he wanted. And he was not a guy who you wanted to get in his way.
I want to ask you about something else which helps lay the groundwork of context for what occurs in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the fact that that the school, although founded by a French priest, becomes more and more reflective of the increasing importance of the Irish among the Catholic Church in America. And you say at one point, the leadership of the Catholic Church in America was increasingly dominated by the isolationist Irish, striving to create a self-sufficient Catholic society. For those of us that are Lutheran or other things, it's important for us to know this facet of the history of the Catholic Church in this country, and in particular in trying to understand this eventual clash between Notre Dame and the Ku Klux Klan.
It is. It was a really interesting thing that, you know, that to research during this book, how the, you know, the French and the German Catholics beat the Irish over here by a few hundred years. And when the Irish started showing up in the late 1800s, they, you know, the Protestant America didn't, you know, had some really, you know, borderline racist stereotypes of the Irish, but the French and German Catholics weren't that fond of them either. And the Irish, well, I'll give you an example. In the front of the book, I quote Father Soren, the founder of the university. This is what he wrote about the Irish in his chronicles. He said, "The Irish are by nature full of faith, respect, religious inclinations, and are sensible and devoted, but a great defect often paralyzes in them all their other good qualities, the lack of stability." So Soren had stereotypes of his own. But the Irish, they had come from a country where their church was very much tied up in, you know, the political struggle of the Irish, and where the church had, you know, virtually been outlawed in various points in history. So when the Irish came over here, they had no interest in democratizing the church. They thought that the goal was to make Catholic society, you know, a separate cocoon, and all these Catholic hospitals, Catholic schools, Catholic publishers, all this was kind of a result of that thinking that American Catholics should live in this cocoon of Catholicism.
Hmm. Well, and then what you call the militancy of Irish church leaders, that was one of the things which maybe helped galvanize the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, I don't want to, you know, blame the victim here. I mean, the Catholics were what they were. I think that what the resurgence of the Klan was more fueled just by the kind of sheer number of immigrants from everywhere. And I think that the classic Klan argument was that Catholics have this allegiance to a foreign ruler, i.e. the Pope, and therefore they can't be completely patriotic Americans. I don't know how aware the average Klansman was of the attitude of Irish bishops in America.
But that attitude that you're talking about of creating almost a self-sufficient society within the American society, that is something that obviously the typical member of the Ku Klux Klan would find really alarming.
It was definitely, a stereotype that the Klan bandied about of the Catholics that there was some truth to, that they wanted to be separate. But I think that, you know, I mean, that's ascribing it to the leadership. I mean, I think the average Catholic in America, was completely American and completely patriotic. I mean, I make that point about Father Walsh, the president of Notre Dame, and kind of the chief protagonist in this story was a distinguished World War One veteran, and Notre Dame was always very conspicuous in its support of wars from the Civil War on, to show that they were, you know, completely on board with the American experiment.
We're talking with Todd Tucker. His book is called Notre Dame Versus the Klan, How the Fighting Irish Defeated the Ku Klux Klan. It's published by Loyola Press. We need to talk about the Ku Klux Klan, and that's, of course, something else so helpful about your book, is that it gives us some history of how the Ku Klux Klan first emerged shortly after the end of the Civil War, and then how it reemerged in the 20th century, primarily up in the North. Of course, the resurgence in the North is what is particularly relevant to,
right,
to
and
our
it was. I mean, the Klan reached its pinnacle in the state of Indiana. That is true.
Give us just a quick sketch of what you think is most important for us to understand about the early history of the Ku Klux Klan, and then how its identity and focus shifted over time.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, the really important thing to take is that the Klan of the 20s was in many ways kind of historically detached from the Klan of Reconstruction. The Klan, the first Klan, the Klan was born immediately after the Civil War as a response to Reconstruction. It was founded in Tennessee, and Nathan Bedford Forrest, the great Confederate cavalry general, was not the founder of the Klan, but he was an early leader. And that Klan was very much designed to kind of restore the social order that had existed in the South before emancipation and before the Civil War. And it was a vigilante, you know, terrorist organization is what it was. Nathan Bedford Forrest finally, he decided it was too violent and disbanded the Klan, and the Klan was dormant for a long, long time. So after Nathan Bedford Forrest issued that order, like I said, the Klan was dormant. The Klan of the 20s kind of resurged because there was a flaky leader of fraternal organizations in Atlanta named Simmons, and he decided he wanted to start a fraternal organization of his own. He'd had phenomenal success selling memberships in a group called Woodmen of the World. And he decided to model his new group after the Ku Klux Klan, and one of the reasons he did that was because there was a movie making the rounds then that was a absolutely groundbreaking motion picture that just changed the way people looked at movies called Birth of a Nation. It was a heroic depiction of the Ku Klux Klan, and the movie was, it was not comparable to anything that had existed before in the world of movies in terms of number of people that saw it, and success, and scale, and scope, so... Simmons decided to hitch his wagon to this movie, and it worked.
Hmm. We should mention that in researching this book, you sat down and watched D.W. Griffith's film.
Birth of a Nation. Yeah, I watched it on videotape. I think it's impossible to recreate. I mean, imagine, if you will, you know, see, for a huge number of the millions of people that saw Birth of a Nation, it was the first motion picture they'd ever seen. So imagine the impact that would have on you.
Right. You also mentioned the fact that Birth of the Nation was the very first motion picture to be shown in the White House.
It was screened in the White House. President Wilson, he was the movie was based on a book called The Klansman, and the author of that book was a friend of Wilson's. They'd gone to Johns Hopkins together.
Hmm.
So there was... controversy, there was surprisingly little controversy about the movie, D.W. Griffith wanted to head some of that off, so they screened it at the White House. And Wilson loved the movie. His famous quote about it was, he said it was writing history with lightning, and that it was all terribly true. He pretty much echoed the sentiments of most Americans, that they just assumed everything they saw in the movie was absolutely accurate.
Hmm. This Simmons, who helped to revive the Ku Klux Klan,
mm-hmm.
Believed that what mattered the most was pure Christianity, that to be native-born white Gentile, and so he had grave concerns and suspicions about anybody that seemed to have allegiance to entities in other places,
right?
And of course, Catholics fell into that suspect group.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think I made the point in the book. I think that the Klan didn't make those notions mainstream. The Klan adopted those notions because they were already mainstream. I think many people had suspicions about these strange foreigners that were coming to our shores in droves, and we're worried about that, and the Klan just kind of capitalized on that fear and made it their own.
You talk about a very important decision which Mr. Simmons made in 1920, which really helped to shape the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan in so many ways, and that was the day which he hired a marketing firm, of all things.
Yeah.
And what a profound difference that made in all of this.
Yeah, well, like many fraternal organizations of the day, these memberships were sold. People did it for a living, and to join the Klan cost $10, which was a sizable amount of money at the time. And so, yes, yeah, Simmons decided to hire this marketing firm. It was called the Southern Publicity Association, and they professionalized the sales force in a way that had never been done before. They gave a commission to salesmen, and they organized them, you know, hierarchically and promoted good ones and fired bad ones, and it had just an amazing immediate effect on the sale of these memberships. And salesmen being salesmen, they played to the room. If they were in the South, they said the Klan was, you know, for white people. And if they were in the North, they said it was for Protestants.
You give us a lot of Ku Klux Klan lingo in this book, which is very interesting. And I mean, it's fascinating. So many things that, and almost all these special terms start with KL.
Yeah, they were, Simmons had a real fetish for that, that everything was going to start with a K.
So, for instance, tell us what a Kliegel was.
A Kliegel was a recruiter. That was an important job in the Klan, and that was and they had various degrees of Kliegels. You could be the Grand Kliegel, and that was what a Kliegel was.
And tell us what a Klecktoken is.
A Klecktoken was that $10 fee to join. It was called the Klecktoken. And you're right, when you read the rules of the early Klan, it's there's just K's everywhere on the page.
Yeah, it's fascinating. A figure who rises to great prominence in the Klan is someone named D.C. Stevenson, who becomes really the champion recruiter of new members of the Klan with one practice in particular, which is just so disturbing to read about because it appears to be so benign on the surface.
The rallies you're talking
about?
Yes. Yeah, Stevenson was, D.C. Stevenson arrived in Evansville, Indiana in 1920, and by sheer coincidence, a gentleman representing the Atlanta headquarters of the Klan arrived in Evansville in 1920 as well, looking for a good salesman to sell Klan memberships in the North, which was where they were trying to expand into. And Stevenson was in many ways kind of a savant when it came to selling. He was a very successful salesman before he'd ever heard of the Klan. He sold a newspaper typesetting equipment and stock, and he was a very successful guy. So when this guy walked around Evansville and said, "Hey, who's the best salesman in Evansville?" D.C. Stevenson was the name he heard the most often. So he sought him out, and you're right. What Stevenson, his main recruiting tactic, which he had learned working for the Socialist Party of all things in Oklahoma, was to have these big all-day picnics and rallies. And they were, you know, if you looked at one now, it would probably look to you like a 4th of July rally. It was all flags and bunting and patriotism and John Phillips, you know, and the Sousa marches and that kind of thing. It was just designed to be kind of an affirmation of patriotism more than anything else.
You also tell the very dramatic story of the first big event like this in which something happened to D.C. Stevenson's, the text of his speech, and he had to kind of make up his speech as he, off the top of his head, but apparently had superb gifts in that respect and was able to really wow the crowd with dramatic results.
He was a great salesman. Stevenson was a great salesman, and he was a great speaker. He could lurch kind of towards the pedantic. He would give these long dissertations on the Constitution. So I guess, you know, I would compare him to like Castro, where he could be, you know, a very emotional, effective speaker, but he could be tend towards the wordy too. But yeah, he in one of his first rallies in the book, I kind of dramatize a situation where he has to improvise a speech, and just by kind of spouting off these catchphrases about 100% Americanism and good, you know, Protestant values, good Christian values, he was able to sell memberships.
Well, and in staggering numbers, you give us a statistic about the presence of the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Indiana at the height of its powers.
At the height of its power, and the Klan membership, one of the big selling points was that it was secret. So the numbers, you'll hear a lot of different estimates, but most people agree that at its peak, the Klan had about 1 out of 3 people in Indiana were members, which included the governor of Indiana was an admitted Klansman, the entire Indianapolis City Council. The mayor of Indianapolis was a Klansman, so it absolutely permeated all levels, and it was by far the most powerful political group in Indiana.
The Ku Klux Klan moves through Indiana in some ways like an invading army. You talk about one of the biggest rallies occurring in Valparaiso, Indiana, where you live now, right?
Right.
And at this point, also a fascinating story which I had never heard, and that was the possibility of the Ku Klux Klan purchasing a struggling school, which we now know as Valparaiso University.
Right, and it was Valparaiso University then, too. And Stevenson had had this rally in Valparaiso and had a lot of success. And as part of kind of his grandiose vision, he envisioned like he called it a common man's Harvard, where it would be, you know, a school ideologically driven by the Klan movement. And he had a price agreed to between him and the trustees, who were, you know, reluctant and worried, but they financially they felt they had no choice. And in the end, Hiram Evans, who was the head of the whole National Klan, he crushed the deal because he was by then already threatened by Stevenson's growing power and thought that the college would be would further augment that. So he crushed the deal to Stevenson's bitter disappointment.
Figure of D.C. Stevenson is an interesting one, not only for this incredible success he enjoys with the Ku Klux Klan, but also a very dark side to his personal life.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, to give your readers, like, just the brief overview, I mean, the whole thing in Indiana, it happened amazingly fast. That, like I said, Stevenson and the Klan arrived in Indiana in 1920. The big rally in Kokomo with 200,000 people took place in 1923. By 1924, the governor-elect was a Klansman, and then 1924 is also when the riot at Notre Dame happened. And then in 1925, Stevenson was convicted of murdering a woman and by basically chewing her to death, and the Klan collapsed. So the whole thing came and went in Indiana in the space of about 5 years.
Which is extraordinary. The Ku Klux Klan eventually takes aim at Notre Dame. And it's kind of interesting, for as quickly as this occurs, it's not like they started out in South Bend, Indiana.
No.
They seem to go about building a strong sense of coalition among so many of these disgruntled Indiana citizens,
right,
before taking aim at this prize target.
Well, yeah, you're right. And South Bend was the second biggest city in the state. But, the Klan held off. South Bend was one of the few cities in the state that had, you know, a high concentration of Catholics. So they held off. It was in some way seen as unfriendly ground for them.
Very much so. At that point in its history, were all the students at Notre Dame Catholic?
No, it's interesting. They've never been all Catholic, and Notre Dame has never required it. And in fact, in those early days you were talking about with Father Sorn, that would have been unthinkable because the school depended on Protestant tuition money so much. So the school was, it's always been mostly Catholic, but it's never been all Catholic. And in fact, back then it was probably less Catholic than it is today, actually.
Hmm. Well, events begin moving quickly as plans are made for large and impressive rallies right there in South Bend, Indiana. And all sorts of figures come into play, which lead to some of the first clashes between Notre Dame students and members of the Ku Klux Klan. I was intrigued by one little detail, and that's one of the best things about a story like this, is the fascinating little details. For instance, as they were distributing announcements about this Ku Klux Klan rally to occur in West Bend, little sheets of paper and the wooden clothespins.
Yeah, that was for the that's one of the ways they transmitted their slate that they wanted people to vote for, was the clothespin campaign. Stevenson, you know, in addition to being a great salesman, he had spent his professional life before the Klan in the newspaper business, and he was really a master of kind of all the media of the day. And so he wanted a way to directly communicate with voters, and it was the clothespin campaign where they folded up the slate. And nowhere on it they identify it as the Klan slate. They just wrote the right slate or the right candidates to vote, and they threw this out on the doorstep of everyone in Indiana the day before the primary and the day before the election.
This is also a time when not only is the Ku Klux Klan trying to gain great influence in the political life of Indiana, but also the Northern Klan is finding itself increasingly at odds with the Southern Klan.
Absolutely, and really, it wasn't so much the institutions as it was the two people. You're talking about D.C. Stevenson in Indiana and Hiram Evans in Georgia. And the two men really kind of personified the two different visions of the Klan. Evans was very much of the old Southern school, where he thought it should be an occasionally violent, fraternal club, whereas Stevenson pictured the whole thing more like a political machine or a grand social movement like abolition or prohibition.
Hmm. And, of course, these had to be such frightening days for those who were at Notre Dame, because as the Ku Klux Klan was rising in influence, there had to be this sense that Notre Dame was this small Roman Catholic island surrounded
isolated,
by
right.
more and more people that seemed to hate it and want it to be gone.
I think you're right. I think it must have been terrifying. And I think that, you know, the official church position and the Notre Dame leadership position by Father Walsh had always been, you know, if we just ignore the Yahoos long enough, they'll go away. And it just, you know, by 1924, you just couldn't say that anymore. When the governor of the state is an avowed Klansman, you know, you can no longer say credibly that it's a fringe movement that'll just die on its own. And there'd been Irish Catholics and Catholics in general that had all along said that we need to take these guys on head on. But, you know, by then it seemed like it had been accomplished.
As you set the stage for this first dramatic clash between Notre Dame students and Ku Klux Klan members, you make a point which is probably significant here, and that is that so many Notre Dame students lived off campus in South Bend, Indiana itself. And you also mentioned the fact that just about all of the Notre Dame students who were known to be kind of disciplinary problems...
Right.
They were the ones living
right.
off campus.
Well, that's probably true today too.
I suppose.
But I think, I think when the university kind of did its postmortem on this thing, they didn't want to look at the grand kind of huge social forces at work. I think if they could have pointed to one thing and said that was the reason why this happened, it would have been because such a high percentage of the students lived off campus. And that was just because the university had been growing so fast, and the university was so strapped financially that they just couldn't build on-campus accommodations fast enough. So huge numbers lived in town. And that was, I think they would have said that was cause number one. Father Walsh had issued a general order the day before, ordering all students to stay on campus. But, in fact, that was just impossible. There were so many of them that didn't even live on campus.
Hmm. And you go on to say that the majority of Notre Dame students found the document made the situation in town even more irresistible. I mean, tell these Notre Dame students that this antagonistic group is
right.
there and that you should stay away from them.
Right.
It in effect seemed to fuel their interest
right.
in doing exactly the opposite.
I guess I draw on my own experience as a hot-headed college boy on that. You get this general order saying that something so spectacular is happening in downtown South Bend that you need to avoid it at all costs. There was no way you were going to keep them away at that point.
Right. You say once sort of the alarm call was made that the Ku Klux Klan was supposedly burning a cross someplace on campus, you say that the students ran the 2 miles into town as if responding to some silent alarm. No one waited for a streetcar. The campus emptied.
And that's based on the eyewitnesses that I interviewed. Nobody wanted to be left out.
Hmm. So what unfolds in that first clash?
Well, the first clash was May 17th, which was a Saturday in 1924, and that was the day of the Klan's big rally, the Tri-State Rally. And at first, it was just students going into town to kind of see what was happening. They were getting these reports that Klansmen were directing traffic as if they were policemen, and that once the students got there, they kind of started just general harassing of the Klansmen, and it kind of degenerated into something maybe a little rougher than that. They started, one of the main kind of prizes of the day was the Notre Dame students wanted to take the robes from the Klansmen as kind of a trophy.
Right. You also tell the story of a cross made out of, I think, red light bulbs,
right.
which was in one of the windows of Ku Klux Klan headquarters.
Yeah, the headquarters was right downtown at the corner of Michigan and Wayne in South Bend, and they had a fiery, quote-unquote, fiery cross that was made of electric light bulbs, like you said, in their third-floor window. That, when the students started kind of confronting and harassing the Klansmen in the street, a lot of them, you got to keep in mind, these guys thought they were going to something that was like a state fair. The Klansmen did not anticipate being confronted. They were usually welcomed with open arms wherever they went. So They start retreating to the Klan headquarters, not knowing where else to go, and so the Notre Dame students gathered there too and decided to extinguish that fiery cross.
Right. You tell us much more about the events of that day and about the uneasy negotiations then that go on in terms of what do we do now? What should law enforcement do now? Should this Ku Klux Klan rally be allowed to occur? How do we keep these Notre Dame students so angry in check? It was not an easy situation in any way.
Well, and it got worse. After that first day, nothing pretty much happened the next day on Sunday. And then on Monday, the first day you could chalk that up as a Notre Dame victory. But Sunday went by without incident. And then on Monday, the Klansmen kind of plotted their revenge. They had the sheriff's department, which was dominated by Klansmen, deputized about 25 Klansmen and ambushed the Notre Dame students. So the potential for violence was growing every day, and it got worse and worse. And there were reports of shots fired on Monday. And the police chief, a guy named Lawrence Lane, who was actually a former Notre Dame student, he called Father Walsh and said, "You got to come down here and get these students away," because it was just it looked like a disaster of really huge proportions was just inevitable. So Walsh came down, and a bunch of the kind of bruised and battered Klansmen had this was at nighttime on Monday. Had gathered on the courthouse lawn, and Father Walsh climbed atop a cannon from the Civil War monument and gave a really dramatic impromptu speech to bring the students back to campus, and they listened to him and left, and that was the end of the riot.
Wow. And, you know, it's interesting how we can scarcely imagine now in this day and age how it was Notre Dame which had the public relations nightmare on its hands.
Oh, it was an absolute catastrophe. Father Walsh, even after the riot, he believed that the best thing to do was still just to kind of ignore the whole thing. And so Stevenson, who was, like I said, kind of a mastermind of managing the media, he took control of the situation early on. And plus the South, the people of South Bend really saw the students as the culprits. In this, they saw him as an out-of-control mob, and you can imagine that, with all the stereotypes that were there, when the students were throwing potatoes to extinguish that fiery cross, it was about the worst possible situation in terms of promoting stereotypes. So, yeah, the students really took it on the chin there in the press as being, mainly at fault.
Well, and Father Walsh expresses sorrow and regret. But on the other hand, you make a point which is probably an important point to make, that not a single Notre Dame student who participated in the riots was ever disciplined by
That's
Father
right.
Walsh.
That's despite the fact that, he had directly ordered him to stay on campus. I think Walsh had always been, a great role model and company man. He joined the seminary when he was 15. He was a war hero. But all his life, he had kind of hung out with, the wilder side on Chicago's Irish side. So, he knew what a young man was capable of. And I think he thought that, the Klan had provoked it, and that something, was inevitable, that something would happen. So he never punished a soul.
Wow. And what, of course, unfolds after this is an interesting story about the Notre Dame football team.
Right.
And that at the end of such a year of controversy, the Notre Dame football team secures a great, great success, which in some way begins to rewrite the story, or certainly rewrite
Yes.
the image of Notre Dame.
Well, I think that's really interesting about where these two institutions, Notre Dame and the Klan, were in history when this riot happened. I mean, the riot took place in May 1924. The following fall, Notre Dame football was already well-known. The George Gipp phenomenon, George Gipp had died in 1920. He was Notre Dame's first All-American. So Notre Dame was known, but in the football season after the riot, they won their first national championship, beat Stanford in the Rose Bowl, and that was on the backs of Newt Rockne and the famous Four Horsemen. So Notre Dame in the football season immediately after the riot became nationally known and nationally beloved. And then conversely, immediately after the riot, D.C. Stevenson, like I said, was convicted of raping and kidnapping and murdering a woman by biting her to death. sentenced to prison, and the Indiana Klan collapsed.
And not just that, but the governor of Indiana is brought down in a scandal as well.
Oh, well, Stevenson, you know, in the wake of his murder conviction, was sure that he still had enough friends in high places that he would be pardoned or something along those lines. And when it didn't happen, Stevenson, always a shrewd man or cunning man, he had stored incriminating documents about his relationship with Indiana politicians in safety deposit boxes all over the state. And so when he wasn't pardoned, he started strategically releasing these documents, including, you know, written contracts with the mayor of Indianapolis. And he brought down everybody, the governor, the mayor of Indianapolis. The entire Indianapolis City Council resigned. So Stevenson was sure that he wasn't going to go down alone.
And as for the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana, I mean, we have these astonishing statistics from their peak that one in three white Indiana males belongs to the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
But within a year or so, the membership plummets from a high of 350,000 to 15,000. I mean, the bottom falls out of this organization.
And I think what that is, you know, like I said, Stevenson's sales pitch when he sold these, you know, Indiana farmers and small businessmen on the Klan was that the Klan was going to defend these Protestant values that they were worried were in danger. So I think when the truth came out about Stevenson's drinking and his kind of, you know, his just, you know, almost animalistic deprivations on this woman, I think it kind of showed the dark underbelly of the Klan and all these people that had been sold on this, you know, patriotic brotherhood were, you know, disillusioned and left in droves.
Hmm. And, of course, the story unfolds from there in such fascinating fashion, but with very few participants wanting to talk very much about this. And
right.
So you've had your work cut out for you, but have managed to uncover so much interesting information about this story and its context. One little bit of information remains elusive. Whatever happened to that Ku Klux Klan robe, which we see in that photograph clutched proudly by that Notre Dame student?
That's a great question. You know, that guy William Fooey, he never mentioned the riot to anybody. His brother went to Notre Dame 10 years after him. I interviewed him, and he never said a word to him. And he never said a word to his grandson, Mark Fooey, who was a friend of mine. So nobody knows what happened to the robe.
The story is such a fascinating one. Again, the book is called Notre Dame Versus the Klan, How the Fighting Irish Defeated the Ku Klux Klan, published by Loyola Press and the author Todd Tucker. Todd Tucker, you have written a fascinating and fine book, and I'm so glad we got to talk about
Thank
it today on
much.
The Morning Show.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to having a conversation with Ginny Sassaman. She happens to be the mother of Jennifer Sassaman from the theater department at UW Parkside. She is in town to do a workshop this weekend on the topic of happiness. And we'll be talking about actually the specific topic of her upcoming workshop as well, which is called Self-Care Tools for a Stressful Time. Also, a look at life in small-town America with the author of a very interesting book called Denison, Iowa. On Thursday, Dr. Thomas Carr joins us from the paleontology department at Carthage College to talk about his latest research. On Friday, we talk politics. Lots to talk about with Dr. Jerry Mast from the political science department at Carthage, a frequent guest to The Morning Show. We remind you that The Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. You'll find the most recent morning shows with direct links right on the front page of our website, and one click will take you to our extensive Morning Show archive. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.